shown to be so incredibly historically accurate over and over and over again that the alleged inaccuracies in Luke are either just incredible stretches. There are things that have been known to be not incorrect for decades or centuries, or in a couple of cases, millennia.
There are things that there's just some little amount of silence that is there in the record, and it's never going to be determined for certain one way or another, and you either have to decide you're not going to trust Luke, or you have to decide that you are going to trust Luke one way or the other. We'll end with a couple of those. But then John is a little more difficult because John doesn't interact with historical information to the same degree that Matthew, Mark, and Luke do. So we just don't find as many opportunities there. There will just be a couple of those. So that's kind of where we're headed. Again, we talked about this basic argument. This is perhaps an oversimplification of it, but this is basically the argument in a nutshell, that if the Gospels are trustworthy, they're not going to contain numerous historical errors. That they do contain numerous historical errors is the accusation, therefore the Gospels are not trustworthy. And as we talked about last time, it is the second premise that is the vital one to keep in mind. It is the one that everything hangs on. And so that's what we've been looking at. First in Matthew and Mark, tonight we'll look at Luke and John. I'll stop again. Any questions about this? If anyone wasn't here and needs a little bit more on this than what we talked about last time or anything along those lines, we in good shape. All right, so we'll skip the big one to start with, which is in Luke chapter 2. That's what we're going to come back to at the end. So we'll begin in Luke chapter 3 and verse 1. There will actually be a couple from this verse that are alleged as inaccuracies in the Gospel of Luke. Luke chapter 3 and verse 1. In the 15th year of the reign of Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate, being governor, or your translation may say procurator, governor of Judea, and Herod being tetrarch of Galilee, and his brother Philip, tetrarch of the region of Iturea, and Trachonitis, and Lysanias, tetrarch of Abilene, during the high priest of Annas and Caiaphas, the word of God came to Zechariah, came to John, the son of Zechariah, in the wilderness, and it goes on to talk about John the Baptist. So in these two verses, we're actually going to run across three things in particular, starting with this issue of what Pilate is called in particular. He is called a governor or a procurator, depending on your translation. And what the skeptics say very often is that this is not the term that was used for this office. And this is an instance where Luke has gotten his historical information mixed up. He is being inaccurate here, to which, you know, we may scratch our heads and say, really, we're going to, you know, cause, you know, great consternation over whether he's called a procurator or a prefect. Is that really a historical error? I think you could kind of look at it from that perspective. And this is a striking thing as well. You may remember when we were talking about some of the minute ways the gospel authors have things correct, we talked about how Luke is so incredibly accurate in the book of Acts, that all of these different regions in Asia Minor and the Mediterranean, where they have different titles of different regional officials, Luke gets every one of those right. For this to be the charge here is a striking kind of thing. Luke has a pretty good track record of getting this very sort of thing right. But for example, one particular biblical scholar named Konzelman, in his book, The Theology of Luke, says that Luke was wrong about the term that he used. This is one of the many inaccuracies that he would point to in the Gospel of Luke. Until about AD 44, the technical term used here was prefect. And this can be seen in some inscriptions. If you look at the inscription data about Pilate, you see that Pilate is called a prefect in a lot of those. He's not called a procurator or a governor, depending on how your translation would render that. And so it, at least on the surface, looks like it could be a problem of some kind. Again, at that point, you have to say, how big of a problem is this really? Especially since they're really terms where one is more specific and one is more general. We talked last time about the issue of locations. You know, one is a regional word, one is a city word. So the example I gave, you know, do the Bucks play in Florida or do they play in Tampa? Well, it depends on if you want to be broadly accurate or very specifically accurate. And you could say the same sort of thing is going on here. It'd be kind of like saying, you know, someone is a congressman versus saying someone is a senator. One is a little bit more of a precise kind of term. But again, what the skeptic would say is this is a later term that is used generally, and this shows that it was written much later and Luke is wrong about his information. The problem with that accusation in particular is that both Josephus in his Antiquities, book 18, and Tacitus in his Annals of Imperial Rome, book 15, use the term that Luke uses to describe Pilate. So not only do two first century historians talk about Pilate and use a term to talk about Pilate, but they use the very same term that Luke uses to talk about Pilate. So what Konzelman and others like him would have to do to say that Luke is wrong is to say also Tacitus and Josephus are wrong as well about the terms that they use. So yes, the inscriptions use the word prefect to talk about Pilate. But there are first century historians that use the same term Luke does to talk about Pilate. And so in the final analysis, unless you're going to say that we, on the basis of inscriptions, know the first century better than first century authors do, it's kind of a ridiculous thing to say. I mean, this is one, like I said, some of the accusations against Luke are kind of silly because we have known that there's nothing wrong with this for decades or centuries or, in this case, millennia. I mean, Josephus didn't write his Antiquities, you know, 5 years ago. This has been around since, you know, not too long after the time of Luke. So this is a bogus accusation to make, and the fact that it gets recycled by anybody at all is kind of ridiculous, is what it is. Especially again when you come to the realization of what this is basically saying is we know their century better than they did. That's really a stretch, Charlie. It depends on who they are and what their purposes are. I mean, if it's somebody who is just nitpicking to nitpick and try to find every possible mistake that they can, they're gaining one more notch on their, wherever they put notches. I don't know exactly what it is. To somebody that would say inspiration means that there are no errors whatsoever of any kind, then this can't be inspired because Luke uses the wrong term. I mean, that kind of mentality. But again, you know, I don't know how everyone would see that. But, I mean, even if Luke was completely wrong about this particular term, is that enough to say, you know, inspiration goes up in smoke? If we take inspiration out of the equation and we're just talking about historical accuracy, if Luke is wrong about this one term and that's the only thing that we can find that he's wrong about, do we say Luke is an inaccurate historian because he gets this term wrong? But again, he doesn't get the term wrong because it's the same term that Josephus and Tacitus used to talk about the exact same person. So it's kind of ridiculous is what it is. Sam? And yeah, and it's the kind of thing where, again, there is very good evidence that after AD 44, this was the term that was used by everybody to talk about all of these people. And so, I mean, you could say very easily that even if it was completely the wrong term, that Luke was using a term that his audience would have understood because he was writing after AD 44. There's no doubt about that. And so even if he does use the wrong term, which he doesn't, you could legitimately say that Luke's purpose was for his audience not to be particularly precise about what Pilate would have been called then, but for his audience to understand the position that Pilate held in their day. So, I mean, even if it was wrong, it's still just not a big deal one way or the other. It's, like I said, it's something of a bogus argument. Charlie? Allegedly, it's the wrong title. It's a different word than he would have been called based on the inscriptions where he is called something else there. But again, it's not wrong because it's the same one that Josephus and Tacitus give. So, All right, I don't want to get hung up on this. We've already spent more time talking about this ridiculous argument than we should have. So the next one is actually in the same verse. It's about Lysanias the Tetrarch. This is another one that has been debunked for quite some time. Lysanias, the Tetrarch of Abilene, is mentioned at the very end of verse 1. The problem with this is that according to Josephus, there was a different Lysanias who was the Tetrarch of Chalcis about 60 years before this. Now, that would be a pretty big historical blunder if Luke is saying that all of this happened at the time that Lysanias was alive and was Tetrarch, but he was Tetrarch 60 years before this. In a completely different place. So that'd be a problem. And so, for example, Wellhausen, or probably Wellhausen, would say that Luke is in error on this regard. The problem is that there has been inscription evidence found that there was another Lysanias who was indeed Tetrarch of Abilene, just as Luke mentioned. And this was found long before Wellhausen wrote his book on Luke. I looked for a picture of this inscription, and I couldn't find anything that was clearly labeled that to know for sure. I've never seen that artifact myself to recognize it off the top of my head. So I was not able to find one. I was hoping that I could to show you what it looks like. But this inscription that names Lysanias as a Tetrarch of Abilene can be very narrowly pinpointed to a specific time because it uses a term to talk about the Caesars that is only used in a very small period of time. It's a term that's only used to talk about Tiberius and the widow of Augustus. The term August Lords is used on this. And we can really narrow it down to the time between Augustus' death, really, and Livia's death, maybe a little bit later than that, but basically it fell out of use after his widow died. So between AD 14 and AD 29 is when this terminology was in use. And this inscription uses this terminology and talks about Lysanias the Tetrarch of Abilene. And so sometime between AD 14 and AD 29 is when this term was used, when this inscription was written. And Luke is writing it about AD 25, 27, somewhere in that range. It's hard to know exactly when John the Baptist is doing this. Well, I guess you could narrow it down very clearly with the 15th year of Tiberius Caesar. So about AD 27 is when this is going on. So you have an inscription that is pinpointed to this very time, naming a different Lysanias, the very one who's mentioned in Luke, not the one who's mentioned in Josephus. And so obviously there were two people named Lysanias who were both tetrarchs at different places at different times. And again, this was known for a very long time. This is not a real problem either because it's been known for quite a while. So again, it's one you may hear, but it's really not that big of a deal. And that's what we're going to find with these in Luke, really. Any comments or questions about Lysanias? Tom, would you recognize that inscription if you saw it? You wouldn't either? Okay. I thought about it. There's something that I found that I thought was probably it, and I nearly stuck it up there, but I didn't want to give you bad information or a bad picture or something. All right, the next verse, we're going to get out of Luke 3, I promise. The next verse talks about Annas and Caiaphas, the high priests during the high priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas. Well, let me give you a couple of quotes from skeptics here. Back in 1845, a fellow named Robert Taylor said, "Any person being acquainted with the history and polity of the Jews must have known that there was never but one high priest at a time." More recently, Fitzmyer, in his commentary in the Anchor Bible series, says, "Since there was never more than one high priest at a time, the phrase raises a question about either the accuracy of Luke's information or his interpretation." So that's mid-60s, I believe, when that was published. So 1800s, 1900s, people are saying Luke has to be wrong because there's only one high priest at a time. And that's very good thinking, really. I mean, you go back and you look at the Old Testament, it's very clear from the Levitical law that there was only one high priest at a time. And so what on earth is Luke talking about, this priesthood of Annas and Caiaphas? Well, this is one you've probably heard some things about. Who could tell me about this situation in the first century? Okay, what does your footnote say?
It says, Annas was high priest from 86 until he was deposed by the Roman official Gratus in 15. He was followed by his son Eleazar, his son-in-law Caiaphas, and four more sons. even though Rome had replaced Annas, the Jews continued to recognize his authority. So Luke included his name as well as that of the Roman appointee, Caiaphas.
Okay. Charlie? Okay. Anything else on that? Yeah, that's basically what happened is the Romans decided that they were going to stick their nose into Jewish religion, and they deposed the high priest that was the proper high priest, who was Annas, and replaced him with a series of Annas's sons and sons-in-law, which I'm sure made him feel fantastic. But the Romans appointed new high priests, and they weren't really accepted by the people, and you can imagine why. I mean, you're a good Jew following God, and you have a high priest who is high priest appointed by the right method that the high priest should be appointed by. They say, no, he's not the high priest, this other guy is. How are you going to feel about that if you're a good Jew? And the answer is not very happy. So you still knew who the high priest was, and if you go back and you read the original documents that talk about this, Josephus and others, it's pretty obvious that they didn't see the Roman-appointed high priest as having any kind of legitimacy. Annas was really the one who was ruling behind the scenes through his sons and sons-in-law. But what they did is they spoke accommodatively of both the Roman appointee and the original appointee as high priest. The one thing you don't want to do is, you know, rub the Romans' nose in the fact that you're going to rebel against what they're doing, because that could cause more problems. They just spoke of both as the high priest. Now, if I just stand here and tell you that, you shrug your shoulders and you say, well, yeah, right, sure, they called them both high priests. That makes perfect sense. Yeah, Luke's wrong. Well, maybe you wouldn't say that, but a skeptic might. And so to that, you go to Josephus in the Jewish War, Book 2. And this is talking about a later time and a later pair of priests. And both Jonathan and Ananias, the high priests. And then he goes on to talk about what these high priests are doing. So again, 2,000 years ago, we have a primary source giving us the exact same language that Luke is using, talking about two people, calling them both the high priest. And so, I mean, these are our instances where the skeptics are raising concern about the accuracy of the Gospels, but they don't know their own history. They don't know their archaeology. They're the ones that have a major problem with their information, not Luke. And again, this is what you find so frequently. Anyone that would go after Luke as a historian is, I mean, they're asking to be crushed by evidence later on. There's not much else you can do with that because, I mean, he was just incredible and impeccable in his history. All right. Also, it's been suggested, and this is, I suppose, probably a little bit more debatable, but Luke uses a singular form here to talk about both of these priests, and that might reflect the fact that he would join in with people and not accepting both of them. That what he's saying is perhaps the high priesthood of Annas, and also Caiaphas is kind of tagging along too, to be something of a rough paraphrase of the idea. Now, that's going to be a little bit more debated from the original language, but that has been suggested by more than one reputable scholar for what that's worth. But again, that would kind of reflect that first century attitude as well, which, you know, people like Fitzmyer and Taylor would be completely oblivious to, apparently. Yeah, Jeremy? Yeah, they look at the way things are supposed to happen based on what comes before it, and they use what they might call historical logic, and they conclude this can only happen this way on the basis, you know, like we talked about last time, the example. There's no mention in the law of a woman ever wanting to initiate a divorce or having any right to initiate a divorce proceeding. Therefore, the Gospels are wrong when they say Jesus said this. Well, except for the fact that very time, Herodias does that very thing. You know, There's only one high priest. Therefore, logic demands Luke must be wrong in talking about two high priests, except for the fact that there were two high priests, and first century authors talked about two high priests. So you can only press this historical logic so far, because the reality is that history is very often illogical. It just doesn't work the way you might expect it to. Apologies, Jonathan.
So confident in your ability to do that, that you, oh, we know this is what happened. You know? And it reminds me of a story that scholars were just convinced that this guy, there were two accounts of him being hung, and they contradicted one another, saying, you know, he was hung in this location, and the other said he was hanged in another location. And obviously, somebody got it wrong, and they didn't really know which one was right. And then some photographs turned up, but they had actually taken a picture of this guy being hanged in both places. So they were both accurate, and nobody would ever expected that to happen, but that kind of thing does happen.
Yeah. Anything else? It's a fantastic story. I'm going to have to remember that. All right, Luke 7, moving along. Oh, it really is. Defying the expectations of historical logic. Luke 7, we find Jesus in Capernaum. We'll read the first five verses to get something of context here. After he finished all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a servant who was sick and at the point of death, who was highly valued by him. When the centurion heard about Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his servant. And when they came to Jesus, they pleaded with him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation. And he is the one who built us our synagogue." Well, the problem with this, allegedly, is that there was no synagogue in Capernaum. So Luke would be wrong about this. This is illustrated marvelously by Robert Price in his book titled The Incredible Shrinking Son of Man. I'm not sure what publisher decided that was a good idea, but this is what Price says. He says, "A major collision between the gospel tradition and archaeology concerns the existence of synagogues and Pharisees in pre-AD 70 Galilee. Historical logic implies that there would have been not have been any Pharisees since..." Historical logic implies that there would not have been any since Pharisees fled to Galilee only after the fall of Jerusalem. So, no Pharisees, no synagogues, because Jerusalem is still standing. Therefore, they don't need Pharisees and synagogues. They don't need synagogues. They just go to Jerusalem. They don't need Pharisees. They haven't left Jerusalem yet to go up there. Therefore, Luke must be wrong. And not only is Luke talking about a synagogue, apparently he's talking about a very impressive synagogue. I think that's the implication here. This guy deserves to be healed because he built us this magnificent synagogue that we have here. It's not like, you know, he threw together a few walls and we have a little shack out back that we go to synagogue. I think the implication is that this is a pretty significant synagogue here. And on top of that, we know that Capernaum was what you might call Jesus' base of operations in his Galilean ministry. That's where he would return to. That's where he was seemed to be doing a lot of his work out of. That was kind of this home base. And so if there is no synagogue, if there are no Pharisees in Capernaum and Galilee before AD 70, this is not just a problem for Luke. This is a problem for everybody. This is a problem for all of the Gospels at this point. Price, by the way, wrote his book in 2003, so this is a very relatively recent skeptical claim to have made. This is the synagogue at Capernaum. It was excavated in 1983. Or at least that's when James Strange and Herschel Shanks wrote their Biblical Archaeological Review article about it. Here's another view of this synagogue, and you get a little bit of the floor plan. This is, in fact, a very impressive floor plan. The walls, the first century walls, there are several layers of walls. I didn't track down a picture of the different layers. There's fifth century walls, if I remember correctly. The first century walls are below that. The first century walls are unusually thick. They're very sturdy walls, which again reflects an impressive, strong kind of structure. The floor plan of this synagogue, and it's hard to say for sure, you know, was this the very synagogue that Jesus was in? Was there maybe another one somewhere else? As far as I would guess, this is a synagogue in Capernaum that was around in the first century. I don't know how many there would have been in town. It's not like it's New York City or anything like that. So my guess is this is probably that very synagogue. But the floor plan is half again larger than any other synagogue that's been excavated in Galilee to date. And so it is a very impressive synagogue. It's the kind of thing that someone would go to Jesus and say, you really need to help this guy because, you know, he ponied up to build us this synagogue that we have. And it's not just any synagogue. It is this synagogue. So again, Luke is shown to be completely accurate. This was written about in a scholarly publication 20 years before Price made his accusation of Luke's inaccuracy. I mean, I don't know what to say about it other than that. And, you know, like I said, with Matthew and Mark, sometimes you got to think about things and work your way through the evidence. With Luke, it's people make absurd accusations and you show them the evidence that everyone's known about for 50 years or more. And like I said, you go after Luke, you're just waiting to have evidence pounded down your throat. Because that's what you're going to find, with the exception of a couple of things that are just kind of out in the open, and you have to make a decision one way or the other. Am I going to trust Luke or am I not going to trust Luke? All right, anything else about the synagogue? Tom, have you been to that synagogue?
Yeah.
Jeremy, you have?
Yeah, most of that is Byzantine.
Right, yeah. The stuff that's still standing is not from Jesus' day.
But there's